chaste and proper manner. There was much to admire about these nuns, cheerful, hard-working, and very devoutly in service to their false god. Now, that wasn't strictly true. They were people of the book, respected by the prophet, but the Shia brand of Islam was somewhat less respectful of such people than... No, he would save those thoughts for another time. He could see it in her eyes, even more clearly than the overt symptoms which his trained senses were beginning to discern. He saw what she already knew. "Please sit down, sister." "No, I must..." "Sister," the physician said more insistently, "you are a patient now. You will please do as I ask, yes?" "Doctor, I..." His voice softened. There was no purpose in being harsh, and truly this woman did not deserve such treatment before God. "Sister, with all the care and devotion you have shown to others in this hospital, please, allow this humble visitor to show some of it to you." Jean-Baptiste did as she was told. Dr. Mouhoudi first donned a fresh pair of latex gloves. Then he checked her pulse, 88, her blood pressure, 138 over 90, and took her temperature, 39. All the numbers were high, the first two because of the third, and because of what she thought it was. It could have been any of a number of ailments, from trivial to fatal, but she'd treated the Makusa boy, and that luckless child was dying. He left her there, carefully picking up the test tubes and moving them to his laboratory bench. Mouhoudi had wanted to become a surgeon. The youngest of four sons, all nephews of his country's leader, he'd waited impatiently to grow up, watching his elder brothers march off to war against Iraq. Two of them had died, and the other had come back maimed, later to die by his own despairing hand. And he'd thought to be a surgeon, the better to save the lives of Allah's warriors, so that they could fight another day in his holy cause. That desire had changed, and instead he'd learned about infectious diseases, because there was more than one way to fight for the cause, and after years of patience, his way was finally appearing. Minutes later he walked to the isolation ward. There is an aura to death, Mouhoudi knew. Perhaps the image before him was something of the imagination, but the fact of it was not. As soon as the sister had brought the blood sample, he divided it in two, sending one carefully packed test tube by air express to the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, USA, the global center for the analysis of exotic and dangerous agents. The other he'd kept in cold storage to await developments. CDC was as efficient as ever. The telex had arrived hours earlier. Ebola Zaire was the identification, followed by a lengthy set of warnings and instructions which were entirely unnecessary. As was the diagnosis, really. Few things killed like this, and none of them so fast. It was as if Benedict Makusa had been cursed by Allah himself, something Mouhoudi knew not to be true, for Allah was a God of mercy, who did not deliberately afflict the young and innocent. To say it was written was more accurate, but hardly more merciful for the patient or his parents. They sat by the bedside, dressed in protective garb, watching their world die before their eyes. The boy was in pain, horrid agony, really. Parts of his body were already dead and rotting, while his heart still tried to pump and his brain to reason. The only other thing that could do this to a human body was a massive exposure to ionizing radiation. The effects were grossly similar. One by one at first, then in pairs, then in groups, then all at once, the internal organs became necrotic. The boy was too weak to vomit now, but blood issued from the other end of his GI tract. Only the eyes were something close to normal, though blood was there as well. Dark, young eyes, sad and not understanding, not comprehending that a life so recently begun was surely ending now, looking to his parents to make things right, as they always had during his 8 years. The room stank of blood and sweat and other bodily fluids, and the look on the boy's face became more distant. Even as he lay still, he seemed to draw away, and truly Dr. Moody closed his eyes and whispered a prayer for the boy, who was just a boy after all, and though not a Muslim, still a religious lad, and a person of the book unfairly denied access to the words of the prophet. Allah was merciful above all things, and surely he would show mercy to this boy, taking him safely into paradise. And better it were done quickly. If an aura could be black, then this one was. Death enveloped the young patient 1 centimeter at a time. The painful breaths grew more shallow, the eyes, turned to his parents, stopped moving, and the agonized twitches of the limbs traveled down the extremities until just the fingers moved, ever so slightly, and presently that stopped. Sister Maria Magdalena, standing behind and between mother and father, placed a hand on the shoulder of each, and Dr. Moody moved in closer, setting his stethoscope on the patient's chest. There was some noise, gurgles and faint tears, as the necrosis destroyed tissue. A dreadful yet dynamic process, but of the heart there was nothing. He moved the ancient instrument about to be sure. Then he looked up. "He is gone. I am very sorry." He might have added that for Ebola this death had been merciful, or so the books and articles said. This was his first direct experience with the virus, and it had been quite dreadful enough. The parents took it well. They'd known for more than a day, long enough to accept, short enough that the shock hadn't worn off. They would go and pray, which was entirely proper. The body of Benedict Macusa would be burned, and the virus with it. The telex from Atlanta had been very clear on that. Too bad. Ryan flexed his hand when the line finally ended. He turned to see his wife massaging hers and taking a deep breath. "Get you something?" Jack asked.
"Something soft. 2 procedures tomorrow morning."
And they still hadn't come up with a convenient way of getting Kathy to work.
"How many of these things will we have to do?" his wife asked.
"I don't know," the president admitted, though he knew that the schedule was set months in advance, and that most of the program would have to be adhered to, regardless of his wishes. As each day passed, it amazed him more and more that people sought after this job. The job had so many extraneous duties that it could scarcely be done. But the extraneous duties, in a real sense, were the job. It just went round and round. Then a staffer appeared with soft drinks for the president and first lady, summoned by another who'd heard what Kathy had said. The paper napkins were monogrammed, stamped, whatever the process was called, with the image of the White House, and under it the words, "The President's House." Husband and wife both noticed that at the same moment, then allowed their eyes to meet.
"Remember the first time we took Sally to Disney World?" Kathy asked.
Jack knew what his wife meant. Just after their daughter's 3rd birthday, not long before their trip to England, and the beginning of a journey which, it seemed, would never end. Sally had fixed on the castle in the center of the Magic Kingdom, always looking to see it, no matter where they were at the time. She'd called it Mickey's House. Well, they had their own castle now. For a while, anyway. But the rent was pretty high. Kathy wandered over to where Robbie and Sissy Jackson were speaking with the Prince of Wales. Jack found his chief of staff.
"How's the hand?" Arnie asked.
"No complaints."
"You're lucky you're not campaigning. Lots of people think a friendly handshake is a knuckle-buster, man-to-man and all that. At least these people know better."
Van Damme sipped at his Perrier and surveyed the room. The reception was going well. Various chiefs of state and ambassadors and others were engaged in friendly conversation. There were a few discreet laughs at the exchange of jokes and pleasantries. The mood of the day had changed.
"So how many exams did I pass and fail?" Ryan asked quietly.
"Honest answer? No telling. They all looked for something different. Remember that. And some of them really didn't give a damn, having come for their own domestic political reasons. But even under these circumstances, it was impolitic to say so."
"Kind of figured that out on my own, Arnie.
Now I circulate, right?"
"Hit India," Van Damme advised. "Adler thinks it's important."
"Roger."
At least he remembered what she looked like. So many of the faces in the line had turned immediately into blurs, just as happened at an overlarge party of any sort. It made Ryan feel like a fraud. Politicians were supposed to have a photographic memory for names and faces. He did not, and wondered if there were some sort of training method to acquire one. Jack handed his glass off to an attendant, wiped his hands with one of the special napkins, and headed off to see India. Russia stopped him first.
"Mr. Ambassador," Jack said.
Valery Bogdanovich Lermontsov had been through the receiving line, but there hadn't been time then for whatever he wanted to say. They shook hands again anyway. Lermontsov was a career diplomat, popular in the local community of his peers. There was talk that he'd been KGB for years, but that was hardly something Ryan could hold against him.
"My government wishes to ask if an invitation to Moscow could be entertained."
"I have no objection to it, Mr. Ambassador, but we were just over a few months ago, and my time has many demands on it right now."
"I have no doubt of that. But my government wishes to discuss several questions of mutual interest."
That code phrase made Ryan turn his body fully to face the Russian.
"Oh? I feared that your schedule would be a problem, Mr. President. Might you then receive a personal representative for a quiet discussion of issues?"
That could only be one person, Jack knew.
"Sergei Nikolaevich?"
"Would you receive him?" the ambassador persisted. Ryan had a brief moment of, if not panic, then disquiet. Sergei Golovko was the chairman of the RVS, the reborn, downsized, but still formidable KGB. He also was one of the few people in the Russian government who had both brains and the trust of the current Russian president, Eduard Petrovich Grushevoy, himself one of the few men in the world with more problems than Ryan had. Moreover, Grushevoy was keeping Golovko as close as Stalin had kept Beria, needing a counselor with brains, experience, and muscle. The comparison wasn't strictly fair, but Golovko would not be coming over to deliver a recipe for borscht. Items of mutual interest usually meant serious business. Coming directly to the president and not working through the State Department was another such indicator, and Lermontsov's persistence made things seem more serious still.
"Sergei's an old friend," Jack said with a friendly smile. "All the way back to when he had a pistol in my face. He's always welcome in my house. Let Arnie know about the scheduling."
"I will do that, Mr. President."
Ryan nodded and moved off. The Prince of Wales had the Indian Prime Minister in a holding pattern awaiting Ryan's appearance.
"Prime Minister, Your Highness," Ryan said with a nod.
"We thought it important that some matters be clarified."
"What might those be?" the President asked.
He had an electrical twitch under his skin from knowing what had to be coming now.
"The unfortunate incident in the Indian Ocean," the Prime Minister said. "Such misunderstandings."
"I'm glad to hear that."
Even the army takes days off, and the funeral of a president was one such day. Both Blue Force and Op Four had taken a day to stand down. That included the commanders. General Diggs's house was on a hilltop overlooking a singularly bleak valley.
But for all that, it was a magnificent sight, and the desert was warm that day from Mexican winds, which allowed a barbecue on his walled and hedged backyard.
"Have you met President Ryan?" Bondarenko asked, sipping an early afternoon beer.
Dig shook his head as he flipped the burgers and reached for his special sauce.
"Never. Evidently he had a piece of getting the 10th ACR deployed to Israel, but no. I know Robbie Jackson, though. He's J3 now. Robbie speaks very well of him."
"This is American custom, what you do?"
The Russian gestured to the charcoal burner. Diggs looked up.
"Learned it from my daddy. Could you pass my beer over, Gennady?"
The Russian handed the glass to his host.
"I do hate missing training days, but..."
But he liked the day off as much as the next guy.
"This place you have here is amazing, Marion."
Bondarenko turned to survey the valley. The immediate base area looked typically American, with its grid of roads and structures, but beyond that was something else. Scarcely anything grew, just what the Americans called creosote bushes, and they were like some sort of flora from a distant planet. The land here was brown, even the mountains looked lifeless. Yet there was something magnificent about the desert, and it reminded him of a mountaintop in Tajikistan. Maybe that was it.
"So exactly how did you get those ribbons, General?"
Diggs didn't know all the story. His guest shrugged.
"The Mujahideen decided to visit my country. It was a secret research facility since closed down. It's a separate country now, as you know."
Diggs nodded.
"I'm a cavalryman, not a high-energy physicist. You can save the secret stuff."
"I defended an apartment building, the home for the scientists and their families. I had a platoon of KGB border guards. The Muja attacked us in company strength under cover of night and a snowstorm. It was rather exciting for an hour or so," Gennady admitted. Diggs had seen some of the scars. He'd caught his visitor in the shower the previous day.
"How good were they?"
"The Afghans?"
Bondarenko grunted.
"You did not wish to be captured by them.
They were absolutely fearless, but sometimes that worked against them. You could tell which bands had competent leadership and which did not."
"That one did. They wiped out the other half of the facility, and on my side..." A shrug.
"We were bloody lucky.
At the end, we were fighting on the ground floor of the building. The enemy commander led his people bravely. But I proved to be a better shot."
"Hero of the Soviet Union," Diggs remarked, checking his burgers again.
Colonel Ham was listening quietly. This was how members of that community measured one another, not so much by what they had done as by how they told their story. The Russian smiled.
"Marion, I had no choice. There was no place to run away, and I knew what they did to captured Russian officers. So they give me medal and promotion, and then my country, how you say, evaporate?"
There was more to it, of course. Bondarenko had been in Moscow during the coup, and for the first time in his life faced with making a moral decision, he'd made the right one, attracting the notice of several people who were now highly placed in the government of a new and smaller country.
"How about a country reborn?" Colonel Ham suggested. "How about we can be friends now?"
"Da, you speak well, Colonel, and you command well."
"Thank you, sir. Mainly I just sit back and let the regiment run itself."
That was a lie that any really good officer understood as a special sort of truth.
"Using Russian tactical doctrine!"
It just seemed so outrageous to the Russian general.
"It works, doesn't it?"
Ham finished his beer.
"It would work," Bondarenko promised himself.
It would work for his army as it had worked for the American,
once he got back and got the political support he needed to rebuild the Russian army into something it had never been. Even at its fighting peak, driving the Germans back to Berlin, the Red Army had been a heavy, blunt instrument, depending on the shock value of mass more than anything else. He also knew what a role luck had played. His former country had fielded the world's finest tank, the T-34, blessed with a diesel engine designed in France to power dirigibles, a suspension system designed by an American named J. Walter Christie, and a handful of brilliant design innovations from young Russian engineers. That was one of the few instances in the history of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics in which his countrymen had managed to turn out a world-class product. And in this case it had been the right one at the right time, without which his country would surely have died. But the time was past for his country to depend on luck and mass. In the early 1980s, the Americans had come up with the right formula. A small professional army, carefully selected, exquisitely trained, and lavishly equipped. Colonel Ham's Op 4, this 11th Cavalry Regiment, was like nothing he'd ever seen. His pre-travel brief had told him what to expect, but that was different from believing it. You had to see it to believe. In the right terrain, that one regiment could take on a division and destroy it in hours. The Blue Force was hardly incompetent, though its commander had declined the chance to come and eat here in order to work with his subunit leaders this day. So badly had they been mauled. So much to learn here. But the most important lesson of all was how the Americans faced their lessons. Senior officers were humiliated regularly, both in the mock battles and afterward in what they called the AAR, After Action Review, during which the observer-controller officers analyzed everything that had taken place, reading their notes off multicolored file cards like hospital pathologists.
"I tell you," Bondarenko said after a few seconds of reflection, "in my army people would be start fist fights during—"
"Oh, we came close to that in the beginning," Diggs assured him. "When they started this place up, commanders got relieved for losing battles, until everybody took a deep breath and realized that it was supposed to be tough here. Pete Taylor is the guy who really got the NTC running right. The OCs had to learn diplomacy, and the Blue Force people had to learn that they were here to learn. But I'll tell you, Gennady, there isn't another army in the world that inflicts humiliation on its commanders the way we do."
"Well, that's a fact, sir. I was talking with Sean Connolly the other day. He's CO of the 10th ACR in the Negev Desert," Ham explained to the Russian. "The Israelis still haven't got it all the way figured out. They still bitch about what the OCs tell them."
"We keep installing more cameras over there." Diggs laughed as he started shoveling burgers onto the plate. "And sometimes the Israelis don't believe what happened, even after we show them the videotapes."
"Still too much hooah over there," Ham agreed. "Hey, I came here as a squadron commander, and I got my ass handed to me more than once."
"Gennady, after the Persian Gulf War, 3rd ACR came here for their regular rotation. Now, you remember, they led Barry McCaffrey's 24th MIC. Kicked ass and took names for 220 miles in 4 days," Ham confirmed. Bondarenko nodded. He'd studied that campaign in detail. "Couple months later, they came here and got the shit kicked out of them. That's the point, General. The training here is tougher than combat. There's no unit in the world as smart and fast and tough as Al's Black Horse Cav."
"Except your old Buffalo soldiers, General," Ham interjected.
Diggs smiled at the reference to the 10th. He was used to Ham's interruptions anyway.
"Well, that's a fact, Al. Anyway, if you can just break even against the Op 4, you're ready to take on anybody in the world, on the wrong side of 3-1 odds, and kick their ass into the next time zone."
Bondarenko nodded, smiling. He was learning fast. The small staff that had come with him was still prowling the base, talking with counterpart officers, and learning, learning, learning.
Being on the wrong side of 3-to-1 odds wasn't the tradition of Russian armies, but that might soon change. The threat to his country was China, and if that battle were ever fought, it would be at the far end of a lengthy supply line, against a huge conscript army. The only answer to that threat was to duplicate what the Americans had done. Bondarenko's mission was to change the entire military policy of his country. Well, he told himself, he'd come to the right place to learn how. Bullshit, the president thought, behind an understanding smile. It was hard to like India. They called themselves the world's largest democracy, but that wasn't especially true. They talked about the most high-minded principles, but had, when convenient, muscled neighbors, developed nuclear weapons, and in asking America to depart the Indian Ocean, it is, after all, called the Indian Ocean, a former PM had told a former American ambassador, decided that the doctrine of freedom of the seas was variably applicable. And for damn sure they'd been ready to make a move on Sri Lanka. It was just that now, the move having been foiled, they were saying that no such move had ever been planned. But you couldn't look in the eyes of a chief of state and smile and say bullshit. It just wasn't done. Jack listened patiently, sipping at another glass of Perrier fetched for him by a nameless aide. The situation in Sri Lanka was complex, and did, unfortunately, lend itself to misunderstanding, and India regretted that, and there were no hard feelings at all. But wouldn't it be better if both sides stood down? The Indian fleet was withdrawing back to its bases, training complete, and a few ships damaged by the American demonstration, which, the Prime Minister said without so many words, wasn't exactly cricket. Such bullies. "And what does Sri Lanka think of you?" Ryan could have asked, but didn't. "If only you and Ambassador Williams had communicated more clearly on the issue," Ryan observed sadly. "Such things happen," the Prime Minister replied. "David, frankly, pleasant man though he is, I fear the climate is too hot for one of his age." Which was as close as she could come to telling Ryan to fire the man. Declaring Ambassador Williams persona non grata was far too drastic a step. Ryan tried not to change his expression, but failed. He needed Scott Adler over here, but the acting sextate was somewhere else at the moment. "I hope you can appreciate the fact that I am really not in a position to make serious changes in the government at the moment." Drop dead. "Please, I wasn't suggesting that. I fully appreciate your situation. My hope was to allay at least one supposed problem, to make your task easier. Or I could make it harder." "Thank you for that, Prime Minister. Perhaps your ambassador here could discuss things with Scott. I'll be sure to speak to him on the matter." She shook Ryan's hand again and walked away. Jack waited for several seconds before looking at the prince. "Your Highness, what do you call it when a high-ranking person lies right in your face?" the President asked with a wry smile. "Diplomacy." Chapter 9. Distant Howls. Golovko read over Ambassador Lermontsov's report without sympathy for its subject. Ryan looked harried and uncomfortable, somewhat overwhelmed, and physically tired. Well, that was to be expected. His speech at President Durling's funeral, the diplomatic community agreed, along with the American media, which was straining its capacity for politeness, was not presidential. Well, anyone who knew Ryan knew him to be sentimental, especially when it came to the welfare of children. Golovko could easily forgive that. Russians were much the same. He ought to have done otherwise. Golovko had read over the official, undelivered oration. It was a good one, full of assurances for all listeners. But Ryan had always been what the Americans called a maverick. He'd had to look up the word, discovering that it denoted a wild, untamed horse, which was not far off the mark.
That made Ryan both easy and impossible for the Russian to analyze. Ryan was an American, and Americans were, and had always been, devilishly unpredictable from Golovko's perspective. He'd spent a professional lifetime, first as a field intelligence officer, then as a rapidly climbing staff officer in Moscow, trying to predict what America would do in all manner of situations, and only avoiding failure because he'd never failed to present three possible courses of action in his reports to his superiors. But at least Ivan Emetovich Ryan was predictably unpredictable, and Golovko flattered himself to think of Ryan as a friend. Perhaps that was going a bit far, but the two men had played the game, most of the time from opposite sides of the field, and, for the most part, both had played it skillfully and well. Golovko, the more experienced professional, Ryan, the gifted amateur, blessed by a system more tolerant of mavericks. There was respect between them.
"What are you thinking now, Jack?" Sergei whispered to himself.
Right now the new American president was sleeping, of course, fully 8 hours behind Moscow, where the sun was only beginning to rise for a short winter day. Ambassador Lermontsov had not been overly impressed, and Golovko would have to append his own notes to the report, lest his government give that evaluation too much credence. Ryan had been far too skilled an enemy to the USSR to be taken lightly under any circumstances. The problem was that Lermontsov had expected Ryan to fit into one mold, and Ivan Emetovich was not so easily classified. It wasn't so much complexity as a different variety of complexity. Russia didn't have a Ryan. It was not likely that he could have survived in the Soviet environment, which still pervaded the Russian Republic, especially in its official bureaucracies. He was easily bored, and his temper, though kept under tight control at most times, was always there. Golovko had seen it bubbling more than once, but only heard of times when it had broken loose. Those stories had percolated out of CIA to ears which reported to Dzerzhinsky Square, God help him as a head of government. But that wasn't Golovko's problem. He had enough of his own. He hadn't entirely relinquished control of the Foreign Intelligence Service. President Grushevoy had little reason to trust the agency, which had once been the sword and shield of the party, and wanted someone he could rely upon to keep an eye on that tethered predator. Golovko, of course. And at the same time, Sergei was the principal foreign policy advisor to the beleaguered Russian president. Russia's internal problems were so manifest as to deny the president the ability to evaluate foreign problems, and that meant that for all practical purposes the former spy gave advice that his president almost invariably followed. The chief minister—that's what he was, with or without the title—took the burden seriously. Grushevoy had a domestic hydra to deal with. Like the mythical beast of old, every head cut off just gave room for another to grow into its place. Golovko had fewer to deal with, but they made up for it in size. And part of him wished for a return to the old KGB. Only a few years before, it would have been child's play. Lift a phone, speak a few words, and the criminals would have been picked up, and that would have been that. Not really, but it would have made things more peaceful. More predictable, more orderly. And his country needed order. But the second chief directorate, the secret police division of the agency, was gone, spun off into an independent bureau. Its powers diminished, and its public respect, fear bordering on outright terror in the not-so-old days, had evaporated. His country had never been under the degree of control expected by the West. But now it was worse. The Russian Republic teetered on the edge of anarchy as her citizens groped for something called democracy. Anarchy was what had brought Lenin to power, for the Russians craved strong rule, scarcely having known anything else. And while Golovko didn't want that, as a senior KGB officer, he knew better than any what damage Marxism-Leninism had done to his nation.
He desperately needed an organized country behind him, because the problems within attracted problems without. And so it was that his unofficial post as Chief Minister for National Security was hostage to all manner of difficulties. His were the arms of an injured body trying to fend off the wolves while it tried to heal. And so he had little pity for Ryan, whose nation may have taken a severe blow to the head, but was otherwise healthy. However differently it might appear to others, Golovko knew better, and because he did, he would be asking Ryan for help. China. The Americans had defeated Japan, but the real enemy hadn't been Japan. He had a desk covered with overhead photographs just brought down from a reconnaissance satellite. Too many divisions of the People's Liberation Army were exercising in the field. Chinese nuclear rocket regiments were still at a somewhat increased alert status. His own country had discarded its ballistic weapons, despite the threat from China. The huge resulting development loans from American and European banks had made the gamble look attractive only a few months before. Besides, his country, like America, still had bombers and cruise missiles which could be armed with atomic warheads. And so the disadvantage was far more theoretical than real. If one assumed that the Chinese subscribed to the same theories, that is. The Chinese were, in any case, maintaining their armed forces at a high state of readiness, and Russia's far eastern group of forces was at a historic low. He consoled himself that with Japan taken out of play, the Chinese would not move. Probably not move, he corrected himself. If the Americans were hard to understand, the Chinese might as easily have been aliens from another planet. It was enough to remember that the Chinese had been as far as the Baltic once before. Like most Russians, Golovko had a deep respect for history. There he was, Sergei thought, lying on the snow, a stick in his hand to fight off the wolf while he tried to heal. His arm was still strong enough, and the stick still long enough to keep the fangs away. But what if there came another wolf? A document to the left of the satellite photographs was the first harbinger of that, like a distant howl on the horizon, the sort to make blood chill. Golovko didn't reflect far enough. Lying down on the ground, the horizon could be surprisingly close. The amazing thing was that it had taken so long. Protecting an important person against assassination is a complex exercise at best. All the more so when that person went out of his way to create enemies. Ruthlessness helps. The ability to snatch people off the street, to make them disappear, was a deterrent of no small value. The further willingness to take away not just a single person, but an entire family, sometimes an entire extended family, and do the same was more effective still. One selected the people to be disappeared, an unhappy pseudo-verb that had originated in Argentina through intelligence. That was a polite term for informers, paid in the coin of the realm or in power, which was better still. They would report conversations for their seditious content, to the point that a mere joke about someone's mustache could entail the sentence of death for its raconteur. And soon enough, because institutions were institutions, informers had quotas to fill. And since the informers were themselves human beings with likes and dislikes, their reports, as often as not, reflected personal slights or jealousy, because the delegated power of life and death was as corrupting to the small as to the great. Eventually a corrupt system was itself corrupted, and the logic of terror reached its logical conclusion. A humble rabbit, cornered by a fox, has nothing to lose by striking out, and rabbits have teeth, and sometimes the rabbit gets lucky. Because terror was not enough, there were passive measures as well. The task of assassinating an important man can be made difficult by the simplest of procedures, especially in a despotic state. A few lines of guards to limit approach. Multiple identical cars in which the target might travel,
often as many as 20 in this case, denied one the ability to know which car to engage. The life of such a person was busy, and so it was both a convenience and a protective measure to have a double or two, to appear and give a speech, and take the risk in return for a comfortable life as the staked goat on the public stage. Next came the selection of the protectors. How did one pick truly reliable fish from a sea of hatred? The obvious answer here was to pick people from one's extended family, then to give them a lifestyle that depended absolutely upon the survival of their leader, and finally to link them so closely with his protection and its necessary ramifications that his death would mean far more than the loss of a highly paid government job. That the guards' lives depended on the guarded one was an effective incentive toward efficiency. But really it all came down to one thing. A person was invincible only because people thought him to be so, and therefore that person's security was, like all of the important aspects of life, a thing of the mind. But human motivation is also a thing of the mind, and fear has never been the strongest emotion. Throughout history, people have risked their lives for love, for patriotism, for principle, and for God, far more often than fear has made them run away. Upon that fact depends progress. The colonel had risked his life in so many ways that he could scarcely remember them all, and done that just to be noticed, just to be asked to be a small part in a larger machine, then to rise within it. He'd taken a long time to get this close to the mustache, 8 years, in fact. In that time he'd tortured and killed men, women, and children from behind blank and pitiless eyes. He'd raped daughters before their father's eyes, mothers before their sons. He'd committed crimes to damn the souls of 100 men, because there was no other way. He'd drunk liquor in quantities to impress an infidel in order to defile that law of his religion. All of this he had done in God's name, praying for forgiveness, desperately telling himself that it was written that his life should be so, that no, he didn't enjoy any of it, that the lives he took were sacrifices necessary to some greater plan, that they would have died in any case, and that in this way their deaths by his hand could serve a holy cause. He had to believe in all of that, lest he go mad. He'd come close enough in any case, until his fixed purpose passed far beyond the meaning of obsession, and he became that which he did in every possible way, all with one objective— that he would get close enough and trusted enough for a single second's work, to be followed instantly by his own death. He knew he had become that which he and everyone around him were trained to fear above all things. All the lectures and the drinking sessions with his peers always came back to the same thing. They spoke of their mission and the dangers of that mission, and that always came down to one subject— the lone, dedicated assassin. The man willing to throw away his own life like a gambling chip. The patient man who waited his chance. That was the enemy whom every protective officer in the world feared, drunk or sober, on duty or off, even in his dreams. And that was the reason for all the tests required to protect the mustache. To get here, you had to be damned before God and men, because when you got here, you saw what really was. The mustache was what he called his target. Not a man at all, an apostate before Allah, who desecrated Islam without a thought. A criminal of such magnitude as to deserve a newly designed room in perdition. From afar the mustache looked powerful and invincible, but not up close. His bodyguards knew better because they knew all. They saw the doubts and the fears, the petty cruelties inflicted on the undeserving. He'd seen the mustache murder for amusement, maybe just to see if his Browning pistol worked today. He'd seen him look out the window of one of his white Mercedes autos, spot a young woman, point, give a command, then use the hapless girl for one night. The lucky ones returned home with money and disgrace. The unlucky floated down the Euphrates with their throats cut, not a few by the mustache himself. If they'd resisted a little too well in the protection of their virtue. But powerful as he was,
clever and cunning as he was, heartlessly cruel as he was, no, he was not invincible. And it was now his time to see Allah. The mustache emerged from the building onto the expansive porch, his bodyguards behind him, his right arm outstretched to salute the assembled multitude. The people in the square, hastily assembled, roared their adoration, which fed the mustache as surely as sunlight fed the flower. And then, from 3 meters away, the colonel drew his automatic pistol from its leather holster, brought it up in one hand, and fired a single aimed round straight into the back of his target's head. Those in the front of the crowd saw the bullet erupt from their dictator's left eye, and there followed one of those moments in history, the sort when the entire earth seemed to stop its spin, hearts paused, and even the people who'd been screaming their loyalty to the man already dead would remember only silence. The colonel didn't bother with another shot. He was an expert marksman who practiced with his comrades almost every day, and his open, blank eyes had seen the impact of his round. He didn't turn, and didn't waste time in fruitless efforts at self-defense. There was no point in killing the comrades with whom he'd drunk liquor and raped children. Others would see to that soon enough. He didn't even smile, though it was very funny indeed, wasn't it, that the mustache had one instant looked at the square full of the people whom he despised for their adoration of himself, then to look Allah in the face and wonder what had happened. That thought had perhaps 2 seconds to form itself before he felt his body jerk with the impact of the first bullet. There was no pain. He was too focused on his target, now on the flat paving stones of the porch, already a pool of blood draining rapidly from the ruined head. More bullets hit, and it seemed briefly strange that he could feel them, yet not the pain of their passage. And in his last seconds he prayed to Allah for forgiveness and understanding, that all his crimes had been committed in the name of God and his justice. To the last, his ears reported not the sound of the shots, but the lingering cries of the mob, not yet grasping that their leader was dead.
"Who is it?"
Ryan checked his clock.
Damn, the extra 40 minutes of sleep would have been nice.
"Mr. President, my name is Major Cannon, Marine Corps," the unknown voice announced.
"That's nice, Major. Who are you?"
Jack blinked his eyes and forgot to be polite, but probably the officer understood.
"Sir, I'm the watch officer in signals. We have a report with high confidence that the President of Iraq was assassinated about 10 minutes ago."
"Source?" Jack asked at once.
"Kuwait and Saudi both, sir. It was on Iraqi TV live, some sort of event, and we have people over there to monitor their TV. We have a tape being uplinked to us right now. The initial word is a pistol right in the head at close range."
The tone of the officer's voice wasn't exactly regretful. "Well, they finally popped that fucker." Of course, you couldn't exactly say that to the President. And you needed to figure who they was.
"Okay, Major, what's the drill?"
The answer came quickly enough. Ryan replaced the phone.
"Now what?" Kathy asked.
Jack swung his feet out of bed before answering.
"The President of Iraq was just killed."
His wife almost said, "Good," but stopped. The death of such a person was not as distant a concept as it had once been. How odd to feel that way about someone who could best serve the world by leaving it.
"Is that important?"
"In about 20 minutes they'll tell me."
Ryan coughed before going on. "What the hell, I used to be competent in those areas."
"Yeah, it's potentially very important." With that he did what every man in America did in the morning. He headed to the bathroom ahead of his wife. For her part, Kathy lifted the remote and performed the other ordinarily male function of clicking on the bedroom TV, surprised to find that CNN didn't have anything on but reports on which airports were operating behind schedule. Jack had told her a few times just how good the White House signals office was.
"Anything?" her husband asked, coming back out.
Not yet.
Then it was her turn.
Jack had to think about where his clothes were, wondering how a president was supposed to dress. He found his robe, moved in from the Naval Observatory after having been moved there from 8th and I, after having been removed from their home, and opened the bedroom door. An agent in the hall handed him 3 morning papers.
Thanks.
Kathy saw that and stopped cold in her tracks, belatedly realizing that there had been people just outside her bedroom door all night. Her face turned away, forming the sort of smile generated by finding an unexpected mess in the kitchen.
Jack?
Yes, honey?
If I kill you in bed some night, will those people with guns get me right away? Or will it wait until morning?
The real work was being done at Fort Meade. The video had traveled from one monitoring station on the Kuwait-Iraq border and another in Saudi Arabia, known as Palm Bowl and Storm Track, respectively. The latter set up to record all signals out of Baghdad, and the former watching the southeastern part of the country around Basra. From both places, the information traveled by fiber-optic cable to the National Security Agency's deceptively small building in King Khalid Military City, KKMC, and uplinked to a communications satellite, which then shot it back to NSA headquarters. There in the watch room, 10 people summoned by one of the junior watch officers huddled around a TV monitor to catch the tape, while the more senior troops, in a separate glass-walled office, sipped their coffee soberly.
"Yes,"
an Air Force sergeant observed on seeing the shot.
"Nothing but net."
Several high fives were exchanged. The senior watch officer, who'd already called White House signals, nodded his more restrained approval and relayed the original signal along the way, and ordered a digital enhancement, which would take a few minutes. Only a few frames were all that important, and they had a massive Cray supercomputer to handle that. Ryan remarked quietly that while Kathy was getting the kids ready for school and herself ready to operate on people's eyes, here he was in signals watching the instant replay of a murder. His designated national intelligence officer was still at CIA, finishing his morning intake of information, which he would then regurgitate to the president by way of the morning intelligence briefing. The post of National Security Advisor was currently vacant. One more thing to address today.
"Whoa," Major Cannon breathed.
The president nodded, then reverted to his former life as an intelligence officer.
"Okay, tell me what we know."
"Sir, we know that somebody got killed, probably the Iraqi president."
"Double?"
Cannon nodded. "Could be, but StormTrack is now reporting a lot of VHF signals that started all of a sudden, police and military nets, and the activity is radiating out from Baghdad." The Marine officer pointed to his computer monitor, which displayed real-time take from the NSA's many outposts. "Translations will take a little time, but I do traffic analysis for a living."
"It looks pretty real, sir."
"I suppose it could be faked, but I wouldn't..."
"There!"
A translation was coming up, identified as emanating from a military command net. "He's dead, he's dead. Stand your regiment to and be prepared to move into the city immediately. Recipient is Replicant Guards Special Operations Regiment at Salman Pak. Reply is, yes, I will, yes, I will. Who is giving the orders? What are my orders?"
"Typos and all," Ryan noted.
"Sir, it's hard for our people to translate and type it at the same time. Usually we clean it up before..."
"Relax, Major. I only use 3 fingers myself. Tell me what you think."
"Sir, I'm only a junior officer here. That's why I draw the midwatch, and if you were stupid, you wouldn't be here."
Cannon nodded.
"He's deader in hell, sir. Iraq needs a new dictator. We have the imagery, we have unusual signal traffic that fits the pattern of an unusual event. That's my estimate." He paused and went on to cover himself like a good spook. "Unless it's a deliberate exercise to smoke out disloyal people inside his government. That's possible, but unlikely. Not in public like this."
"Kamikaze play?"
"Yes, Mr. President. Something you can do only once, and dangerous the first time.
Agreed.
Ryan walked to the coffee urn. The White House Office of Signals was mainly a military operation, and they made their own. Jack got two cups and came back, handing one to Major Cannon, rather to the horror of everyone else in the room.
Fast work. Send a thanks to the guys working this, okay?
Aye, aye, sir.
Who do I talk to get things happening around here?
We got the phones right here, Mr. President.
I want Adler in here ASAP, the DCI.
Who else? State and CIA desks for Iraq. DIA estimate of the state of their military. Find out if Prince Ali is still in town. If he is, ask him to please stand by. I want to talk to him this morning, if possible.
I wonder what else.
Ryan's voice trailed off.
CENTCOM, sir. He'll have the best military intelligence troops down at Tampa, most familiar with the area, I mean.
Get him up here.
No, we'll do that by landline, and we give him time to get briefed in.
We'll get it all going for you, sir.
Ryan patted the officer on the shoulder and headed out of the room. The heavy door closed behind him before Major Charles Cannon spoke again.
Hey, NCA knows his shit.
Is it what I heard? Price asked, coming up the corridor.
Do you ever sleep?
Then he thought about it.
I want you in on this.
Why me, sir? I'm not...
You're supposed to know about assassinations, right?
Yes, Mr. President.
And right now you're more valuable to me than a spook.
The timing could have been better. Daryai had been surprised by the information just delivered. Not in the least bit displeased by it, except maybe the timing. He paused for a moment, whispering a prayer first of thanks to Allah, then for the soul of the unknown assassin.
Assassin? He asked himself.
Perhaps judge would be a better term for the man, one of many who'd been infiltrated into Iraq ages ago, while the war had still been going on. Most had merely disappeared, probably shot one way or another. The overall mission had been his idea, not nearly dramatic enough for the professionals working in his intelligence service. Largely leftovers from the Shah's Savak, trained by the Israelis in the 1960s and 1970s. They were effective, but they were mercenaries at heart, however much they might protest their religious fervor and their loyalty to the new regime. They'd proceeded along conventional lines for the unconventional mission, trying bribes of various sorts or testing the waters for dissidents, only to fail at every turn. And for years Daryai had wondered if the target of all that attention might have Allah's perverse blessings somehow or other. But that had been the counsel of despair, not of reason and faith, and even Daryai was subject to human weakness.
Surely the Americans had tried for him also, and probably in the same way, trying to identify military commanders who might like to try out the seat of power, trying to initiate a coup d'etat such as they had done often enough in other parts of the world. But no, this target was too skilled for that, and at every turn he'd become more skilled. And so the Americans had failed, and the Israelis, and all the others. All but me. It was tradition, after all the way back to antiquity. One man operating alone, one faithful man who would do whatever was necessary to accomplish his mission. 11 such men had been dispatched into Iraq for this specific purpose, told to go deep undercover, trained to forget everything they had ever been, entirely without contact or control officers, and all records of their existence destroyed, so that even an Iraqi spy in his own agencies could not discover the mission without a name. Within an hour, some of his own cronies would come into this office, praising God and lauding their leader for his wisdom. Perhaps so. But even they didn't know all the things he had done, or all the people he'd dispatched.
The digitized rendition of the event didn't change much, though now he had a more professional opinion of the options.
Mr. President, a guy with a Silicon Graphics workstation could fake this, the NIO told him.
You've seen movies, and movie film has much higher resolution than a TV set.
You can fake almost anything now.
Fine, but your job is to tell me what did happen, Ryan pointed out. He'd seen the same few seconds of tape 8 times now, and was growing tired of instant replay.
We can't